Can you push those tables over, the ones by the door? I don't think there are enough for everybody. Maggie Chung stood wrapped in her padded coat in the middle of the draughty community hall, directing furniture like a drunken policeman directing traffic. Her brow furrowed in concentration. She would gesticulate emphatically, then swiftly change her mind, sending Kate or one of the students back across the room with their screeching cargo of formica tables or moulded chairs, as she tried to determine the best way to fit everybody in. Behind her, in a circle, a group of elderly Chinese women chattered loudly and obliviously in Cantonese, engrossed in a game of something like dominoes. On opposite sides of the room, near the old men sipping jasmine tea from plastic beakers, two young women, both as silent and miserable as their children, ignored each other and the solitary younger man between them. "There aren't going to be enough chairs, no matter how you do it," said Ian, the manager, after a quick burst of mental arithmetic. "The helpers can eat standing up," said Maggie. "It's still going to be tight. It might be better to do two shifts." Ian's downcast expression and grey pallor illustrated the difficulties of a life of publicly funded compromise. "Better to squeeze everyone in than do two sittings," observed Maggie. "That way we stay warmer." "I'm sorry about the heating," said Ian for the fifth time. "It's the budget cuts. We have to save what we've got for elderlies and new mums on Tuesdays and Fridays." Kate, now warm through effort, hauled her two tables across the room and slotted them, under Maggie's instruction, into a circular arrangement close to the kitchen. Despite the other woman's confidence, she couldn't see how everyone would be able to eat lunch at the same time. But Maggie was insistent. This group was meant to forge bonds between old and young, the newly arrived and the long settled. And there was no point in having an outreach group if all you were going to do was divide them. "Besides," she said cheerfully, "it's our culture. Everyone eats together." Kate didn't point out that Maggie's much-referred-to culture was somewhat elastic, taking in trips to McDonald's with her sons, split-shift dining with her doctor husband, who worked erratic hours at the local hospital, and a devotional love of Coronation Street. There was never any point in arguing with Maggie. Like a well-practiced politician, she would simply mishear anything that didn't fit into her current worldview, and cheerfully restate her opinions as if they had never been questioned. "There, all done," she exclaimed some minutes later. "And we can keep the tables like this afterwards. Did I tell you, I've persuaded one of the teachers from Brownlee School to come and do reading and writing skills. If I see another housing benefit form, I think I'm going to die."
"If I don't have some success with Mr. Yip's form, I think he's going to make sure I'm the one that dies," said Ian.
It was the closest he came to humour, and Maggie and Kate smiled obligingly. "You're not telling me they've sent it back again. Fourth time. I wouldn't mind, but it's me who fills it in. If I can't do it, after 11 years working for the council, how the hell can anybody else be expected to?" Kate had become a volunteer helper at the Dalston and Hackney Oriental Outreach Group almost a year before Jeff left. One night, when he had emerged blinking from the American Journal of Applied Psychiatry, he had bemoaned the shockingly high rates of mental illness in immigrants, prompted by the isolation, alienation, and racism of their inner-city placements, and had talked of Maggie's work in trying to combat it. Kate had been surprised at the extent of Maggie's involvement. Despite a lengthy friendship, Maggie and she tended to restrict their conversation to partnering kids. But then he had brought it up again when Maggie and Hamish had come for supper, and Kate had discovered that Maggie's reticence had only been due to a perceived lack of interest on her own part. In turn, Maggie had swiftly elicited a feeble promise from Kate to come and help. "I don't know what I could do," she said, not sure if she really wanted to. But when Maggie discovered that Kate's early years had been spent in Hong Kong, there was no prospect of escape.
"My God, woman, you know Chinese culture," she had exclaimed.
You were practically Chinese. And ignore Kate's protestations that from the age of 8, her culture had consisted of boarding school in Shropshire and village life in Southern Ireland. So what? She responded. I've never lived further east than Thaden Boys. Even after all these months, Kate was of little practical help. Unlike the other volunteers, she couldn't speak the language, she couldn't cook, and she couldn't find her way around the Kafka-esque requirements of the Social Security forms. All she could offer was backup help with the reading classes and her physical presence. But Maggie didn't seem to mind, and Kate had actually enjoyed some of it. Watching the volunteer chef from the local takeaway cook authentic Chinese dishes in the centre's little kitchen. Observing the way the older people appeared so much closer and more animated than their European equivalents. She had enjoyed her brief immersions into a different world. She liked the way Maggie switched like a spinning negative from English to Chinese. The way she gathered these disparate people around her, bringing them together by sheer force of her personality. And in some perverse way, working at the group had helped assuage the guilt she had felt about leaving Jeff, providing an opportunity to buy herself some atonement once a week for her sins. Most of the time it worked. I didn't think you were coming today, said Maggie, appearing suddenly at her shoulder. Her lack of height meant it was uncommon to view her from any other angle, despite her fondness for spike heels. I nearly didn't, Kate admitted. Not really in the mood. It's always better to get out of the house if you're feeling miserable. Away from gas ovens. Oh, no, you're electric, aren't you? We'll talk at lunch. I don't know if I'm going to stay for lunch. Maggie wasn't listening. Look at them. They should be talking, she exclaimed, drawing Kate to one side and pointing at one of the silent young mothers. Two young girls, two babies. It's absolutely ridiculous having them both sitting there in silence. We must get them talking. Mind you, that one there, we've got to get her to take her baby for inoculations. She's been here nearly 6 months, but the silly girl won't go to the health centre. 4 weeks after he had brought the girl to England, Maggie said, her husband had left, telling her he was going to earn some money. Apart from an unconfirmed sighting in Nottingham, that had been the last time she had heard of him. She had permission to remain in the country, but no job, a shared bedsit, and not enough money to return home. She just needs to get talking to people, open up a bit. You go and chat to her while I see how lunch is coming on, she instructed, and bustled off. Working at the centre usually put Kate's own problems into perspective, but she had had second thoughts about coming all morning. The mood of despond, prompted by her home's unnatural silence, had left her, perversely, with little appetite for company. Sabine had once told her that they divided girls in her class into drains and radiators. Radiators being those popular girls who gave out interest and enthusiasm, drawing people around them, and drains being, well, drains, those who sucked out atmosphere and goodwill like a vacuum. Today, Kate thought, she was a definite drain. A drain who had to be a radiator. Dragging her feet like a schoolgirl, Kate walked slowly over to the young girl, who sat slumped in her cheap anorak, plastic shoes, and a pervasive stench of misery. She wasn't sure how she could help in the face of such momentous despair, and Maggie knew that the girl spoke no English. But with the bossily evangelical air of a Sunday school teacher, she just expected people to get on with it. Those with a will would find a way. Kate took a deep breath, stopped a short distance away from the girl, giving her time to realise she was approaching, then smiled and gestured towards the baby. Hello, she said. I'm Kate. The girl, her hair scraped back in a ponytail and faint bluish shadows, denoting more than the young mother's customary lack of sleep, looked blankly at her, then around the room, looking for Maggie or one of the Chinese helpers. Kate, she said, pointing at herself, aware that she was speaking too loudly, like an imbecilic colonial, expecting that volume alone would help the natives understand. The girl looked at her, wide-eyed and expectant. With a gesture as insubstantial as she looked, she shook her head. Kate breathed deeply. What on earth was she meant to do? She didn't have that gift for putting people immediately at their ease. Most of the time she felt too ill at ease herself. "I'm Kate. I help out here," she said helplessly. Then, "What's your name?" The resulting silence was broken by a burst of laughter from the other side of the room, and the rapid gunfire of scattered dominoes hitting a tabletop. The elderly players had concluded their game. Maggie moved among them, exclaiming and congratulating in Chinese, her sleek black hair obscuring her face as she leant over to examine the board. Kate turned back to the girl, trying to maintain her smile. "Boy or girl?" she said, indicating the infant, whose sleeping face was just visible beneath the layers of donated clothing. "Boy?" she waved at the man seated nearby, who looked at her with an expression of distrust. "Or girl?" she pointed at herself. Oh, God, but she sounded like an idiot. Her smile now becoming painful to maintain, she moved closer to the child. "Your baby is beautiful." It was. When asleep, they all were. The girl looked at her baby, then back at Kate, clutching the child slightly tighter to her as she did. "I'm going to give up," thought Kate. "I'll just point her towards the food table and let Maggie do it. I'm just not any good at this." She thought briefly, longingly, of her empty home. Then, suddenly, two words flashed into her brain, a mental echo. Two words from her childhood, whispered softly from her armour's lips. "How leng?" she said, gesturing towards the child. Then louder, "How leng?" The girl looked down at the baby and back up again. She frowned slightly, as if unable to believe what was being said. "Your baby. How leng?" Two sweet, soft words. Very beautiful. The international language of flattery. Kate felt a surge of warmth. She could do this after all. She racked her brains, trying to remember whether she had achieved the correct tones. "How leng? Very beautiful," she said again, smiling with benevolent delight. Then Maggie appeared behind her. "What are you doing to the poor girl?" she said. "She doesn't speak Cantonese. She's from the mainland, you daft woman. She speaks Mandarin. She won't have a clue what you're going on about." Tall, slim, public school Hamish was an unlikely partner for Maggie. People had been saying so for the 18 years they had been married. It was not just Maggie's height, her dark, earthy voluptuousness against his insubstantial pallor, or the noisy Chinese immediacy of her and her children's emotions set against Hamish's northern European placidity. It was just that she seemed too much for him. Too much for almost anyone Kate could think of, come to that. She was too loud, too upfront, too sure of herself. Kate was fairly sure she had not changed one iota since adolescence. It was why Hamish adored her. Kate, on the other hand, had changed with practically every man she had ever been with. It was the changes they had wrought in her that had determined how far she fell for them. With Jim, she had been the rock chick parent, had enjoyed the loose, loving way with which he had treated both her and her daughter. The way that for the first time since Sabine's birth, she had not felt entirely defined by her status as mummy. He had given her back some of her youth, she had thought at the time, lightened her up, enabled her to stop worrying, taught her about sex. But then, when things had begun to go wrong, and she had been suspicious, She had hated the person he made her become. Hated being that paranoid, unhappy wretch, begging for truth, desperately changing her appearance in an attempt to win back his attention from the unseen threat. And when he had gone, the sadness had been tinged with relief that she didn't have to be that person any more. When Jeff had moved in, she had been an older, wiser lover. She had not given as much to him, conscious of the need this time to hold something back. Yet he had given her everything. Everything he had, that was. With Jeff, she had become a grown-up. He had expanded her mind, talked to her about politics and society, and made her look harder at the injustices of the world around her. If the comfort outweighed the passion, that was fine, she had told herself. She was probably better with someone who kept her steady. With Jeff, she had learnt to use her brain, and it had felt like growing up. And he had been so sweet with Sabine, never attempting to push himself on her or play daddy, but simply providing her with his solid backdrop of love and wisdom. But then, 6 years on, had come Justin, who had made her realise that a whole side of her had lain dormant for years, which now insisted on bursting through to the fore. She was a sexual being, and he made her sexual, and once it had sprung forth, like a geyser, it refused to be subdued. No one had made her glow like he did. No one left her blushing and walking giddily, like a drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. No one had surrounded her with a virtual aura of sexuality, a fitting cloak of pheromones, so that she found herself turning heads, drawing wolf whistles, even when dressed down. And she deserved it, didn't she? She had told herself, desperately trying to rationalize the hurt she was about to cause. She was allowed another chance. Why should she have to give up on romantic love at the age of 35? Is this a thin person conspiracy? While you've been sitting there dreaming, I've eaten nearly all the ching fun. Maggie perched against the sink unit of the kitchen, waved her chopsticks vigorously in front of Kate's nose. Just because you can't tell the difference between Cantonese and Mandarin doesn't mean you're not allowed to eat the food. Sorry, said Kate, pushing at her lunch as it congealed in the bowl. She'd thought she was hungry, but her appetite, so erratic of late, had chosen again to disappear. Oh, God, not lovesick still. Not the can't-eat-a-thing stage at, what is it now, 3 months? I don't know what stage I'm at, said Kate miserably. Yes, I do, the guilty stage. Maggie raised a carefully plucked eyebrow. When Kate had revealed she was leaving Jeff for Justin, she had expected that Maggie, who had known Jeff longer, would automatically take sides. But it hadn't happened. Maggie, perhaps fittingly for someone apparently able to hold two conflicting points of view at once, also appeared to have a capacity to retain dual loyalty. The guilty stage? Oh, don't be so wet. For goodness sake, you're happy, aren't you? Justin's happy? Jeff is, let's be honest, hardly suicidal. Not the type with all that psychiatric training. Probably giving himself a good therapeutic talking to even as we speak. She honked with laughter, sending a piece of noodle flying across the table. It's not Jeff, it's Sabine, Kate said. I'm wrecking her life. Maggie took a last paper-wrapped prawn, sighed deeply, then pushed her bowl towards the overflowing sink. I see. So it's adolescent hell, is it? The girl child giving you a hard time? Not as such. She hardly talks to me, but I can see it written all over her face. She thinks I've ruined her whole life, and she hates me for sending her to stay at my mother's. Now that you can't blame her for, if what you have told me is at all true. But as for ruining her life, don't be so melodramatic. She grinned at Kate. Fine coming from me, I know. But come on. She's hardly an abused waif, is she? Kate gazed at her, desperate for reassurance. Maggie held up one hand and began ticking off her plump fingers. One, is she clothed and fed? Yes.
too bloody well, if you ask me. All that ridiculous label stuff. 2. Have you ever brought anyone cruel into her life? No. All your men, well, both your live-in men, have absolutely adored her. Not that the little madam has ever given them much back, bless her. 3. Was Jeff her real daddy? No, as she was at great pains to tell him on any possible occasion. 4. Will she leave home within the next few years and without a backward glance? Absolutely. Oh, well, that makes me feel a load better. Just being honest, darling. All I'm saying is that you worry too much. Sabine is about as well-adjusted a teenager as you can cultivate around here. And I mean that in a positive way. She's bright, she's bolshy, and she doesn't take shit from anyone. You have no need to worry. But she doesn't talk to me anymore. She just stopped talking. She's 16, for God's sake! I didn't speak to my parents for about 4 years, and there were 2 of them. But what if it's because of me? What if she keeps on hating me? You wait till she wants a car, or a deposit on her first flat. The love will return, believe me. The love will return. Kate gazed out of the window at the grey frontages of Kingsland Road. The car stereo and hardware shops, the local cafes, grubby advertising hoardings and benefit offices that proved that no matter what the estate agents insisted, this up-and-coming area resolutely insisted on going no further. What had made her think her daughter was going to be any better off in the cloistered green acres of Kilcarrion? What could have they ever done her? She toyed with a plump pink prawn, pushing it on a solitary journey around the rim of her plate. Do you ever get bored of Hamish? She wasn't sure where the question had come from, but once it was out, she realised she needed to know the answer. Maggie, her cup raised to her mouth, lowered it slowly and considered with equal levity her answer. Bored? I don't know if I get bored exactly. I sometimes want to throttle him. Will that do? But what makes you stay together? You can't be happy all the time, can you? The last 2 words came out a little plaintively, so Kate tried to turn them into a joke. Of course we're not happy all the time. No couple is happy all the time. And if anyone tells you they are, they're bloody lying. But you know that, Maggie frowned. What is this, Kate? Honestly, you sound like a 15-year-old talking about relationships sometimes. That's because I feel about as good at them as a 15-year-old. But what makes you stay together? What keeps you hanging around at the point at which you want to disappear? The point, she thought silently, in which I usually disappear. What keeps us together? Apart from the cost of a good divorce lawyer and the fact that our house has hardly risen in value over 5 years? Oh, and those evil trolls masquerading as our children? The truth, Kate? I don't honestly know. Yes, I do. It's that despite him being a complete arsehole sometimes, crap with money, frequently drunk, and frankly not a great shag, apart from birthdays and special occasions. I genuinely can't imagine being with anyone else but Hamish. Does that help? I've never been in a relationship where I haven't imagined being with someone else, confessed Kate sadly. Oh, I'm not counting fantasizing about Robert Mitchum. Nor am I. Oh, God. Robert Mitchum? I know, Maggie grinned. He's my guilty secret. He just looks like he'd be so stern, you know? But I'm not counting sexual fantasies. I've always thought about being with someone else. I have crushes on other people and stuff. You are 15. I knew it. Oh, God, what's wrong with me? Why am I so bloody useless at relationships? She hadn't meant to say it out loud. Maggie began gathering up the empty bowls piled up on trays around the kitchen. Hate to say this, gorgeous, bearing in mind your current squeeze and all that. But perhaps you just haven't met the right person. Justin rang at 6:45, shortly before Jeff was due to arrive.
Kate was grateful for his call. Grateful that over the tinny telephone line, the sound of his voice could still flood her with warmth and longing, reassure her that her decision had been the right one. It had been rather unnerving, her conversation with Maggie, even if she had brought it all upon herself with her overly introspective mood. Now Justin, ringing unexpectedly, put it all right.
"I was thinking about you," he said, "and I just wanted to hear your voice."
"Oh, I'm so glad you did," she said a little breathlessly. "I miss you so much."
"God, I wish you were here.
I can't stop thinking about you." His voice sounded a million miles away.
"How's everything? Where are you?"
They spoke simultaneously, then broke off, each unwilling to interrupt the other.
"You first," said Kate, cursing the telephone system for the awkward time lags.
"Look, I can't talk long. I just wanted to say that I'll probably be back by the weekend. We've only got one more person to see, and then I'm hoping to leave the others here and get out on an early flight.
Do you want me to meet you at the airport?
Just ring when you've got your flight details."
"No, don't bother. I'm not a great fan of all that arrivals reunion stuff." Kate bit back her disappointment.
She had had a vision of them embracing in the middle of Heathrow, he dressed in dusty khaki, lines of exhaustion wiped from his face at the sight of her.
"For God's sake," she scolded herself. "Maggie was right. You really are 15.
"I'll cook something nice then, for when you get back."
"You don't need to do that."
"I want to."
"I miss you."
"I just mean that I'm likely to be knackered and filthy, and will probably head home first and sleep for 12 hours. I'll see you when I'm clean and rested. We'll go out somewhere fun."
Kate told him she would look forward to it, trying to hide the disappointment she felt at his lack of urgency. She wanted to see him as soon as he touched down, sweaty, exhausted, or whatever. She wanted to smother him in kisses, run him a hot bath, hand him glasses of wine as she listened to his tales of derring do, then feed him up with home cooking and watch him doze contentedly on her sofa. But Justin wasn't really the dozing kind. In fact, she had a strong suspicion that Justin was somewhere, not a million miles, from hyperactive. He found it difficult to sit still anywhere. He fidgeted and tapped his fingers on his knees, scratched at his sandy hair and paced the room. She supposed it was what made him good at his job. Even in his sleep he flinched and murmured, as if on some constant nocturnal trail. Restless, Kate walked slowly up to her room and stood staring at herself in the long mirror on the door of the Edwardian wardrobe.
"What does he see in me?"
she thought, feeling suddenly vulnerable, at odds with herself.
"He could have anyone, and yet he picked me. A 35-year-old woman with stretch marks and the definite beginnings of crow's feet, and hair that was, while luxuriant and red, apparently too long for her age, according to her daughter. A woman who, having missed out on her youth, had never got to grips with fashion, not knowing where she quite fitted into it all. Sabine told her that the 1950s and 1960s second-hand clothes she got from the shop in Stoke Newington were a joke, but she had liked them, liked the good fabrics and the feeling of quality that she couldn't afford in a wardrobe of today. She had liked the fact that they separated her from all those 35-year-old mums she saw at Sainsbury's. But now, under a cloud of self-doubt, she wondered whether she simply looked odd, out of place. "Will he go off me?" she thought, peering at her reflection. He was the same age as her, but his whole lifestyle was so transient, so free of responsibility, that it could have belonged to someone 10 years younger. Would he ultimately want someone who shared that freedom? Kate closed her wardrobe door, trying to displace the thoughts crowding into her head. She was just no good at being alone. It gave her too much time to think, to mull everything over. Too much of her happiness was dictated by her love life, that's what Maggie had said. She made herself too vulnerable that way. She had denied it,
but had been notably unable to come up with reasons why Maggie was wrong. And Maggie had said what she did without knowing half of it. How Kate had spent a fortune on new bed linen because Justin had once remarked that he slept best on white Egyptian cotton. How she had turned down at least 2 well-paid commissions because she wasn't sure when he was getting back and didn't want to be working when he arrived. How she found it altogether too much effort to look nice when Justin wasn't there and had spent most of his absence in her black plastic reading glasses and a pair of pyjama bottoms. God, but she was no good at being alone. She would get a lodger, or a dog, or something. Anything to stop these depressive thoughts. Come on, she scolded herself. Jeff will be here soon. Straighten yourself up. Glad of a reason to stop thinking, Kate brushed her hair, marvelling at the tangles that could be caused by 2 days' neglect, applied her lipstick, and then, without thinking, perfume, Mitsuku by Guerlain, then stared in horror at the bottle. Jeff had bought her that perfume every Valentine's Day. It was his favourite. He might think she had changed her mind, that she wanted to win him back. Kate stared at her reflection, and then, after a moment's hesitation, took a tissue and rubbed off the lipstick. She did up the top button of her 1950s cream silk blouse, removed her contact lenses and put on her unflattering work glasses. Then she wiped at her neck with a handkerchief, trying to remove the scent. She had hurt him enough already. The last thing she wanted to do was unwittingly inflame his passion. With that in mind, a flat, aged, washed-out Kate, the kind she had just spent the last 2 hours fretting about, was the most thoughtful gift she could offer him. He arrived late, which surprised her. Jeff was always punctual. It was one of his things. She was almost grateful when the doorbell eventually rang. She had found herself seated in silence in the living room, staring, as if for the first time, at the gaps in the bookshelves and the spaces on the walls where his belongings had been. How would Sabine feel when she saw so many familiar things missing? Had she been attached to any of them? Had she even noticed them? How did you know what was going on in the mind of an enigma? He looked, she noticed, as he walked past her down the hall, a little better than the last time she had seen him, less aged by it all. But perhaps that was no surprise. That had been moving day. The weeks since had been an age for both of them. He stood in the living room, a tall, slightly stooped man of 50, apparently unsure whether to sit down. Suddenly, perversely glad to see him, Kate smiled nervously at him and gestured towards the sofa. "Do you want a drink? Your stuff's upstairs, but I know you've had a drive. And I don't want you to feel you have to head straight off again." Jeff rubbed at the back of his salt and pepper hair, a gesture she had never seen before, and sat down tentatively. "Actually, I only came from Islington. I'm headed back there, too." Kate was sure he had said he was renting a place in Bromley, near the psychiatric hospital, but she said nothing. Innocent queries held the capacity to become loaded. It was none of her business anymore. "Tea? Coffee? Red wine? There's a bottle open." "The wine will be great, thanks." She fussed with the bottle in the kitchen, marvelling at how swiftly one's partner could metamorphose into a formal guest. When she handed his glass to him, she felt his eyes search her face, and it made her flush with unwelcome emotion. "So, how are you?" he said, which threw her somewhat, because she had expected to ask it of him. I'm fine," she said. "Doing okay." "Is Sabine still at your mother's?" "Yes. She didn't like it much to begin with, but she hasn't rung this week. With her, I guess that's a good sign." "No news is good news." "Something like that. Give her my love when you next speak to her." She nodded. "Of course I will." There was a lengthy pause. Kate noticed that the top button of her blouse had come undone, and wondered whether to do it up would look like she was making a point. She pulled her thick cardigan tighter around her, hoping that would solve the problem. "You've not got the heating on," he said, as if he had suddenly noticed the cold. "I've had a few problems with the boiler." "The man's coming tomorrow," she lied.
"Is he any good?" "You don't want to have cowboys messing around. They can wreck the whole thing. Electrics, plumbing, the lot."
"Oh, he's very good. Registered and everything."
"Good. Because you only have to let me know.
He tailed off awkwardly.
"Well, anyway, I'm glad you've got it sorted."
Kate stared at her wine glass and felt wretched. It was worse that he was being nice. She found it easier when he was yelling at her. When she had told him about the affair, he had screamed that she was a whore. A word that, curiously, had failed to hurt her at the time, in part because it was what she secretly felt herself, but also because it was the only really nasty thing he had ever said, and it gave her an excuse to feel furious with him.
"Actually," he said, "I need to talk to you."
Kate's heart leapt into her mouth. Jeff was gazing at her, his eyes soft, his face kind. "Please don't be in love with me any more," she begged him silently. "I can't bear the responsibility."
"Shall I get your stuff down first?" she said briskly. "Then we can talk afterwards."
"No,"
she stared at him. "Look, I'd like to talk to you now." "We spend our whole lives trying to get men to talk," she thought. "And when they do, we wish we were a million miles away."
At that point, Goebbels padded silently into the room, his black coat bristling and dusted with raindrops. Ignoring Kate, he walked up to Jeff, and after sniffing with a studied lack of interest at his trouser leg, jumped lightly up beside him on the sofa.
"Not you, too," thought Kate desperately.
"This is all very awkward," he began.
"No, no, it's me who should feel awkward. Jeff, I'm so sorry about what happened. I really am. You're such a wonderful man, and I'd give anything for things not to have turned out the way they have. I'm so, so sorry. But I've moved on. Moved on, you know?"
Here she smiled at him in a way that she hoped conveyed all the love and thanks she had felt for him over the years, and also her determination that there was nothing left to resurrect.
"That's very sweet," he said, looking down at his shoes.
They were new, she saw. Thick-soled, expensive-looking. Very unlike Jeff.
"I'm glad you said that, because I felt slightly awkward about coming here today."
"You need never feel that," Kate said earnestly, half believing that she meant it. "Sabine will always want to see you, and I will always..." Here she struggled for the right words. "Always care about you. I would hate to think that we would never see each other again."
"You really feel that?" He was leaning towards her, both hands resting lightly on his knees.
"I do," she said. "Jeff, you've been a huge part of my life."
"But you've moved on."
Kate felt her eyes fill with tears. "I have."
"I'm glad," he said,
and for the first time his expression relaxed.
"Because what I need to tell you, well, I was a bit worried because I didn't know how you were."
Kate stared at him, uncomprehending.
"Look, it just makes it a bit easier for me, because I've moved on too. I've met someone."
Kate's mind went blank. Jeff shook his head slightly, as if what he was saying was unbelievable even to himself.
"I've met someone, and it seems pretty serious. It's made me realize that you were right. You were right to do what you did." "Oh, I know I was as hurt as anything at the time. You can't believe how hurt. Which makes it all the more astonishing, really, that this could happen so quickly. Because when did you tell me? What was it, 6 weeks ago?"
Kate nodded dumbly.
"But this person, this woman, has made me understand that your decision was incredibly brave. Because we were just drifting. We weren't really challenging each other or making each other happy. And I've got that now. And if you've got it too, well, God, I can't believe I'm saying this. I just feel that it's all worked out somehow for the best. As long as Sabine is okay, that is.
There was a faint ringing sound in Kate's ears. She frowned, trying to get rid of it.
Are you okay? Said Jeff, reaching out a hand.
I'm fine, she said softly. Just a bit surprised. The shoes, she thought. This woman had made him buy the shoes. He had been gone 3 weeks, and already this woman had him buying decent shoes. Who is it? She said, lifting her head. Is it anyone I know?
Jeff looked a little uncomfortable. That's what I wanted to talk to you about. He paused. It's Soraya.
Kate looked blank. Then, Soraya? Not Soraya from your work.
Yep, that's Soraya.
Soraya who has come here for dinner, what, 5 or 6 times?
Yes.
Soraya, Asian queen of psychiatry. Soraya, 40-something doe-eyed goddess of quality designer labels and expensive shoes. Soraya, inheritor of a vast, immaculately furnished Georgian house in Islington, a private income and no children.
Soraya, witch, husband stealer, bitch, bitch, bitch.
She didn't waste any time, did she? She couldn't keep the note of bitterness from her voice.
Jeff shrugged and smiled ruefully. She was pretty careful to ask whether it was definite. She's very proper about such things, you know. When I told her it was, she told me that if she didn't snap me up, someone else would. She reckons there's a shortage of decent grown-up men.
He had the grace to blush at repeating her compliments, but neither could he hide his pride in them.
Kate could not believe this.
Jeff, snapped up by the most eligible single woman either of them knew. Jeff, who had suddenly become the glittering prize of the female middle classes. How had this happened? Was she so short-sighted that she had missed some quality in him all along?
I only told you because you said you were happy with Justin. I would never do anything to hurt you, you know that.
Oh, don't worry about us, we're fine, ecstatic. She knew she sounded childish, but somehow couldn't help it.
They sat in silence for some minutes, Kate drinking her wine too fast. Eventually she spoke again.
Is it really serious?
Yes, it is.
After 3 weeks?
No point hanging around at my age.
He tried to make it sound like a joke. What, as in living together? She was incredulous. How could he have a new life already, when she had not even begun to come to terms with the loss of their old one?
Well, I've got the Bromley place on a 3-month lease, but, yes, I spend most of my time in Islington.
How nice for you.
You know that stuff has never been important to me.
Kate stared at his shoes. Until now, she thought.
Soraya will have you kitted out and turned into one of those designer intellectuals, all Nicole Fari jackets and linen shirts before you know it.
Jeff stroked the cat.
Both of them looked too much at ease.
Did anything happen between you before?
The suspicion which had wormed its way into her mind had filled her head suddenly like a multi-headed toxic Medusa.
What? Well, this all seems terribly convenient, doesn't it? 3 weeks after you move out of here, you're practically moved in with one of our good friends. You've got to admit it's pretty fast work.
Jeff's expression was deadly serious. Kate, I can categorically promise you that nothing happened until you told me about your... about Justin. I had thought of Soraya as an attractive woman, but no more than any of our friends. Well, perhaps more attractive, But I'd never thought about her more than anyone else, if you know what I mean.
He was telling the truth. Jeff had always found it impossible to lie. So why did she feel so bitter?
She says she always liked me, but she wouldn't have gone near me while I was with someone else. And if she hadn't made a move, well, I would have probably slunk into my rather horrid new flat and licked my wounds for years. You know how I was. You know how I am. I'm just not the type for infidelity.
And I am, she thought, although you're too kind to say it. Kate, feeling inexplicably left behind, realized she wanted to howl, to shout and scream uninhibitedly like someone cheated, and cry until her chest heaved and her stomach muscles hurt. And it was all her own fault. Perhaps, she thought insanely, she would seduce him, leap on him, claw off his clothes and make love to him with an animalistic passion that would leave him trembling, no longer smug and secure about the rightness of his new love. She wanted him insecure, anxious. She wanted to obliterate Soraya and her enigmatic Asian smile. She could do it. She knew she could do it. She knew him better than anyone, after all. Then she saw that Jeff was staring at her, his expression gentle and concerned. It was the kind of look, she realized, that he normally reserved for his patients. And that was worse than the infidelity. She pulled at her glasses, remembering with discomfort her pale, unmade-up appearance. Are you okay?
Okay? God, I'm great. Just stunned by your wonderful news. I'm so pleased for you.
She stood, letting her silk shirt flop open at the collar.
Isn't life grand, eh?
Jeff, aware that their meeting was being called to an abrupt close, stood also, placing his half-drunk glass of wine on the side table.
You sure you don't mind?
Believe it or not, it's important to me that you're okay with this. Kate's eyes glittered.
Mind? Why should I mind?
She smoothed her hair, looking absently around the room.
Justin will be so amazed when I tell him how everything's worked out.
So amazed.
And pleased. Yes, we're both very pleased. Now, let's get your stuff, shall we?
She said brightly, and with a broad, fixed smile, walked towards the door. Chapter 4.
That's it. Heels down, sit up straight. There, see? You're doing grand. I feel like a sack of potatoes.
You're doing fine.
Lift your hands up a bit, just off his neck.
They're the only thing keeping me on board. Sabine scowled into her scarf as Tom grinned at her, her breath sending a soft, hot blast back up against her face. She had to admit she was almost enjoying herself. Not that she was going to let him know. The little grey horse moved obediently under her, its ears flicking backwards and forwards as Tom talked, its neck arched like that of a rocking horse. It hadn't tried to buck her off, bite her, kick her, swerve into a hedge, or bolt into the distance, as she had secretly feared. It hadn't even eyed her with that expression of malevolent intent particular to the riding school horses, but instead seemed simply satisfied to be out, enjoying the crisp winter morning, accepting its human passenger as a necessary cost.
"I told you your gran was a good judge of horse flesh," Tom said from the greater height of the big bay horse beside her. He held both reins in his right hand, western style, while his other arm hung loosely down his left side.
"She wouldn't have put you on anything too lively. She made sure this one here was absolutely bomb-proof before she let them send it over. I heard her on the telephone myself."
Sabine sensed that at this point she was meant to express gratitude or admiration, but she couldn't. Her grandmother had seemed barely to notice her the past few days, and when she did, it was only to observe some wrongdoing on her part, like not washing the mud from her boots before putting them in the boot room, and letting Bertie sleep on her bed in the afternoon. She had even shouted at Mrs. H. for putting the wrong sort of butter on Grandfather's scrambled egg, bringing the tray back down herself, and going on and on about it, as if poor old Mrs. H. had tried to poison him or something. Sabine had wanted to shout back at her, but after her grandmother had gone back upstairs to his room with a reloaded tray, Mrs. H. had put a hand on her shoulder and said it didn't matter. "She's under a lot of strain. We have to give her a bit of leeway," she said. "Why does everyone let them get away with it?" she asked Tom, as he dismounted to open a wooden gate.
"Who?
Get away with what?"
"Them, my grandparents. Why do you all stay working for them when they're so awful to everybody? I can't believe they pay you a great whack. She's always going on about economizing."
She spat out the word as if it tasted bad. Tom pushed open the gate, tapping his horse on its side so that it pirouetted clumsily around him, and Sabine rode through, her horse's hooves making crude sucking noises in the mud. "She's all right."
"No, she's not. She never says thank you to you for all the things that you do. And she was rude to Mrs. H. yesterday, and yet none of you answers back."
"No point. She doesn't mean it personally."
"That's no excuse."
"I'm not saying it is. But people have their ways, and that's hers." "God, it's cold this morning." With a grunt, Tom shoved his foot in the stirrup, and pushing up, swung his other leg over the back of the horse. His boots were caked in mud.
"But it's demeaning. She treats you like servants, like you all lived in the 19th century.
Tom patted the bay horse's muscular neck.
"Well, I suppose you could say we are her servants." "That's ridiculous. Your staff."
Tom was grinning again now. His smile rose up above the scarf wrapped tightly around his neck.
"So what's the difference?" "There just is a difference. Go on."
Sabine stared at her horse's ears. Back and forth went the right one. Tom could be immensely irritating sometimes.
"It's what she makes it. Them. Both of them. The difference is in how they treat you. As equals, or as, well, without any respect."
She glanced furtively at Tom, wondering if she'd gone too far. She had realized halfway through the conversation that he might legitimately be offended by what she was saying. But he just shrugged and pulled a wet leaf from an overhanging branch.
"I don't see it like that. They're good people, your grandparents, but with old-fashioned ways. You've got to remember that they grew up with servants. They grew up in the colonies. They like things done a certain way, and they're just old and easily frustrated if that doesn't happen. Now,"
Tom pulled up his horse and turned to look at her,
"if it was just one person they treated badly, or shouted at, or whatever, I think we'd all walk out. There are no mugs in this place, Sabine, whatever you might think.
But we understand them, and their ways. And although you might not see it, they respect us, too." Sabine still didn't agree, but something in Tom's manner meant that she was disinclined to pursue the conversation further.
"And no matter what you might think of her right now, Mrs. H. is right. Your grandmother is under a lot of strain. You should open up to her a bit, Sabine. Talk to her. You might just be surprised."
Sabine shrugged as if it were beyond her to care. But the strain her grandmother was under, she knew, was down to her grandfather's encroaching ill health. He hadn't come down from his room for 5 days now, and the doctor, a young locum with an earnest manner, had been a frequent visitor. Sabine hadn't liked to ask what was wrong. On the one occasion Mrs. H. had asked her to take up his lunch tray, he had been asleep, and she had stood frozen in the doorway, appalled and fascinated, as, above the vibrant red of the oriental bedspread, the skeletal head painfully drew breath, wheezing and spluttering in fitful slumber. She couldn't have told if he looked unwell. He was too old to look anything but, well, old.
"Is he going to die?"
she asked Tom. He turned in his saddle and stared at her briefly, then looked away as if considering something.
"We're all going to die, Sabine.
That's not an answer.
Well, that's because I can't give you an answer. Come on, the weather's closing in. We'd better get these horses in.
It had all stemmed from the night of the hounds. Nearly a week ago, Sabine had woken in the early hours to what sounded like a pack of wolves outside her window, their voices raised in a strangled, anguished chorus. They howled not in a mournful way, but with a kind of urgent bloodthirstiness, a blood-curdling harmony, a song to raise primeval fears. Chilled, she had climbed slowly out of her bed and padded barefoot to the window, half expecting in her dreamlike state to see a full moon. Instead, in the dim blue light, she had just been able to make out below her the thin figure of her grandmother, her dressing gown pulled tightly around her, running through the stable yard, a candlewick apparition. She was shouting at someone to come back. It wasn't the furious electrified cry of someone chasing a criminal, but brisk, yet almost pleading. "Come back, darling," she said. "Come back now, please." Sabine had stood, her hand raised at the window as her grandmother disappeared, unsure what to do. She half wanted to help, and yet she had the strong sense that she was intruding on something private. Then, a few moments later, the howling had stopped, and she had heard footsteps. Then her grandmother's voice again, this time soft and scolding, as it was when she spoke to the Duke. Sabine had pushed back the curtain to see her grandmother slowly walking her grandfather back towards the back door. He stooped and limped, and the wind moulded his pyjamas around him in the wind, so that his bones seemed to poke right through, like warped coat hangers.
"I was just checking on the hounds," he kept saying. "I know that man's not feeding them enough. I was just checking on the hounds."
Sabine and her grandmother had not spoken about this incident. Sabine wasn't even sure if she was supposed to know about it. But from then on, her grandfather had not emerged from his room. And at night, occasionally when she half woke, she could hear the brisk padding of her grandmother's steps along the corridor, as she checked that her husband was still in bed and had not disappeared on another nocturnal mission. Her curiosity awakened, Sabine did, however, ask her grandmother whether she could go and see the hounds. She had wanted Tom to take her, but her grandmother, after giving her one of her looks, as if she couldn't quite believe Sabine might be interested, said she could come up with her later that afternoon. "They're black and tans," she told Sabine as they walked briskly through the stable yard. "It's a special breed of hind. We've had them in this area for generations." She pronounced it hind. It was the longest sentence she had spoken to Sabine in over a week. "The Ballantines were always masters of foxhinds. That's the leader of the hunt. They started the pack at the end of the last century, and your grandfather has spent the best part of his life making sure it carried on. He was master until about 10 years ago, when he stopped riding. They're a wonderful pack. The last time I went out, you should have heard them give tongue." She paused briefly and smiled, savouring her reminiscences. Sabine, fighting the urge to giggle at her grandmother's last words, didn't tell her she had ulterior motives. She was convinced the poor dogs would be kept cruelly. No contented animal could make a noise like those dogs had made. And the thought that they lived in concrete sheds, away from the comforts of warm fires and worn rugs, made her feel almost tearful. What she would do when she saw them, she wasn't quite sure. On her bad days, she resolved to set them free, or contact the local animal rights people to make a fuss. But that would get all of them into trouble, including Tom. On her better days, she didn't think about them at all. They were kept a 5-minute walk from the house, in a yard surrounded by concrete pens, some of which had high metal gates or heavy-duty wire in front. It looked like a sort of prison, thought Sabine sourly, as she skipped to keep up with her grandmother. It smelt of disinfectant and dog excrement, and something else foul she couldn't identify. How could she look after her Labrador so well, yet leave these dogs out in this cold?
"How's Horatio doing, Niall?"
"A little better, Mrs. Ballantyne," said the middle-aged man who had emerged from one of the sheds as they approached. He wore a long leather apron like a blacksmith, and his face centred too closely around his nose, as if someone had squashed it altogether.
"The dressing should come off that foot fairly soon, and it's all healing up nicely underneath. Shall we have a look?"
It wasn't a question. Her grandmother marched briskly over to a corner pen and peered into the dark. From behind her, Sabine could just make out a dog lying in the straw, its bandaged paw tucked protectively under its body. "What happened to it?" Sabine asked the man. The dog had raised its ears at his arrival, as if expecting something, and drooped a little when he turned away to face her.
"Got run over by a horse.